2 weeks ago, I was speaking about the need for us to be able to conceive of something before we can act on it. We have to act on it before we can feel anything. And as we feel, so our body reacts. I mean, everything flows from our thoughts, what it is that we conceive and what we really believe. I think I've said in here several times that the reality we believe is a reality we endure. I mean, that is so true. As we believe, so we act. And what we do repeatedly creates the feelings and the attitudes that we have toward life, which then directs our body on what to do, you know. So this is the key aspect, I think, the beginning point. Our problem as Westerners is we want to leave everything in our heads. And then it never travels down that path that makes any difference in our lives. And so, yes, it begins with our thoughts, but it certainly doesn't end there. That's just the first step. When I'm counseling people, the first thing that I tell them is that I'm a counselor and not a therapist. You know, what is that line? Jim, I'm a doctor, not a brain surgeon. I'm a counselor, not a therapist. Which means that we need... I love you Trekkies out there. You guys are great. We need a shared reality in order to proceed. You know, if we're not sharing reality, if we can't put something on the table and agree that it's square and it's brown and it's so big and so on, if we can't do that with our language, then counseling is of no value. We got to be able to communicate with a shared reality. And sometimes that's possible and sometimes it's not. And if it's not, that's where the therapy comes in, to dig those things up out of the subconscious where you can't quite get to them and bring them. Centering prayer can do the same thing. What I wanted to talk about today, though, is this idea of a shared reality about life. Because I wasn't just whistling Dixie during communion today. There are so many people that I know, including Marion and me, that are going through so many difficult things. And we sort of cry out, don't we? We say, what's wrong? Well, you know, it's not supposed to be this way. Well, is it not supposed to be this way? I don't know. Let's turn to Scott Peck, shall we? Let's see what he has to say. And I put the first paragraph of the first page of his first book. I think it was his first book, called The Road Less Traveled. Came out of the 80s. But it's an amazing book. And this first paragraph in the first page that I want to read you is so instructive. Because listen to what he's saying. First line, life is difficult. Just let it sink in for a minute. Life is difficult. This is a great truth. One of the greatest truths, he says. It's a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters. You buying that? Sounds great, but you got to buy it. You know? I think we all know life is difficult. Do you think that once it's accepted, that it can change your attitude toward it? He continues, just listen. Most of us do not fully see this truth that life is difficult. Instead, we moan more or less incessantly, noisily or subtly, about the enormity of our problems, our burdens, and our difficulties, as if life were generally easy, as if life should be easy. We voice our belief, noisily or subtly, that our difficulties represent a unique kind of affliction that should not be, and has somehow been especially visited upon us or else upon our families, our tribe, our class, our nation, our race, or even our species, but not upon others. I know about this moaning because I have done my share. Life is a series of problems. Do we want to moan about them or solve them? Do we want to teach our children to solve them? Discipline is the basic set of tools we require to solve life's problems. Okay, so he's holding out discipline there. Without discipline, we can solve nothing. With only some discipline, we can only solve some problems. With total discipline, we can solve all problems. What makes life difficult is that the process of confronting and solving problems is a painful one. Problems, depending upon their nature, evoke in us frustration or grief or sadness or loneliness or guilt or regret or anger or fear or anxiety, anguish, despair. These are uncomfortable feelings, often very uncomfortable, often as painful as any kind of physical pain, sometimes equaling the very worst kind of physical pain. Indeed, it is because of the pain, that events or conflicts engender in us all, that we call them problems in the first place. And since life poses an endless series of problems, life is always difficult and is full of pain, but joy as well. Yet, it is in this whole process of meeting and solving problems that life has its meaning. Problems are the cutting edge that distinguishes between success and failure. Problems call forth our courage and our wisdom. Indeed, they create our courage and our wisdom. It's only because of problems that we grow mentally and spiritually. When we desire to encourage the growth of the human spirit, we challenge and encourage the human capacity to solve problems. Just as in school, we deliberately set problems before our children to solve. It is through the pain and confronting and resolving problems that we learn. As Benjamin Franklin said, "Those things that hurt instruct." It is for this reason that wise people learn not to dread, but actually to welcome problems and actually to welcome the pain of problems. And he's speaking right out of the book of James right now, isn't he? You know, I remember the last non-ministry job I had, office job. I was working, it's been 10 years or something like that, I think, and developed a computer problem that I could not figure out, driving me absolutely insane. You know, the kind of keyboard slamming frustration that you feel when you just can't get your keyboard to do what it needs to do, your computer to do. So I called in a computer networking fix-it guy, like Aaron, and he comes in there, sits down at my computer, and all of a sudden this smile spreads across his face. And I said, "What are you smiling at?" He said, "I've never seen this kind of problem before." He was excited. Well, he's a geek, you know, but he's excited because he'd never seen that kind of problem before, you know. And for me, it was just driving me crazy. Now, you know, in my defense, the problem was keeping me from what I really needed to do. And as a computer geek, that was what he needed to do. But even so, he had an attitude toward the problem that made his face smile. He was excited to encounter something he'd never encountered before so he could figure out how to fix it. Put another tool in his belt, I suppose. Is it that hard for us to do those sorts of things? You know? On the other hand, we ask, why is life difficult? Okay, I accept that it's difficult, but why is it difficult? Couldn't it just be as easily something else? Something less difficult? Something less painful? Does it have to be that? So Scott Peck is telling us that problems are the key to growth, and discipline is the key to solving problems. Right? The problem with us is that difficulty without meaning is really suffering, isn't it? In fact, I can't even think of a better term for suffering or a definition for suffering than difficulty or pain without meaning. Because once we have meaning, we can get through the difficulty. We can even find virtue in the difficulty. We can overcome the suffering. We know that there's a reason that we're doing it. And so part of this whole attitude for life and about life is finding the meaning that is inherent in the difficulties that we face. Now, Jesus has a different word for this. Let's take a look at John 14:15. He says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." So keep my commandments. What's that code for? Obedience, right? We're supposed to obey something that he's telling us to do. In Jesus' case, he's asking us to follow something that he is already doing in his life. His commandments were the way that he actually lived life, the choices he made, the way he related. You know, his commandment was to love each other as I have loved you. That's a commandment. He said, if you will do that, then you love me. So he's drawing now a connection between love and obedience. There's a connection somehow. You've got to figure that out. And then at John 8:31-32, he says, so Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And I know I quote that all the time, but it's so central. But here, looking at it from this point of view, if you continue in my word, same thing again, keep my commandments, continue in my word, obey, follow what I do, truly be my follower. What kind of follower are you if you don't do the things that the master does, if you don't actually follow the path? He says, if you obey, if you continue in my word, then you're my followers, and you will know truth, and truth will make you free. So now he's making a connection between obedience and truth and freedom. You see how that works? Obedience, truth, and freedom. Well, wait a minute. Isn't obedience sort of the opposite of freedom? I mean, if I have to obey someone, how am I free? To be free, I'm supposed to be able to do whatever I want, right? So how is obedience connected to freedom? How does this actually work? How are they connected causally, I guess, is the best way to put it. In other words, how does something that is sort of not free by definition lead to freedom? This is the thing that we have to figure out, because I'll tell you what, it seems like I'm missing something here. You know, obedience plus life's difficulties is supposed to lead us to truth, to meaning, to purpose, to freedom. I mean, how does that exactly work? I want to take a step back for a second. Last month, Stephen Hawking made a big splash, and I'm sure some of you read about it, because I know several of you wanted to talk about it with me. He wrote a new book with a co-author called The Grand Design, and he was kind of offering his latest theories about everything. And if you don't know Stephen Hawking, he is the Cambridge professor who for the last 40 years has been the premier cosmologist and astrophysicist, theoretical physicist in the world. And he's the one with Lou Gehrig's disease, so he's in the wheelchair and he has to talk through that funny little mechanized voice, you know. But the reason that this book made such a splash this time is because there is a section in there where he says, at the beginning of all things, it's not necessary to have God. Because of the way the universe is constructed, the way that we're starting to understand the universe, he said there's not a need for a first cause. And he had several really interesting arguments, and they sound pretty wacky, but, you know, mathematically, I guess they must work out. But basically, he's saying that, you know, if you add up all of the matter, all of the energy in the universe, both negatively charged and positively charged matter and antimatter, it all cancels each other out, so that in the final analysis, the total value of energy in the universe is zero. So you sort of get the universe for free. If the universe contains zero energy, then it takes zero energy to produce it. And as we observe these subatomic particles, you know, these tiny little particles, they pop in and out of existence all the time. It's the fabled quantum leap, you know. They wink into existence, they wink out of existence. And so what he's saying is that we have these laws like gravity and all these laws, and they are in effect their own first cause. That the universe could just randomly wink into existence and look like this one. And, oh, by the way, there's probably an infinite number of universes out there, all with different attributes. Okay. Math was not my best subject at school. In fact, I was pretty bad at it. And I don't hold the Lucasian chair of mathematics at Cambridge University like he did for 30 years. But it seems to me that there's a major flaw here, a fly in the ointment. Because all of the laws of physics and all of the tools, mathematics included, that we're using to measure the universe are included within the universe. And we're trying to describe something that, by definition, exists outside the universe. So how does that exactly work? If we're using the laws of physics to describe the origin of the universe, which defines the laws of physics, it seems like we've missed something. You know, there was an ancient cosmological model of the universe that the whole flat Earth sat on the back of an enormous turtle. Have you heard this one? It was, early man came up with this idea. And then, of course, you have to ask, well, what's the turtle standing on? And the answer is, well, it's turtles all the way down. But see, for us, living inside this space-time bubble, living inside this universe, there's always got to be another turtle. And eventually, there is no turtle. You know, we can only get back so far. It's like you want to go from point A to point B, and you go half the distance again, half the distance again. When do you arrive? Never, because you're always halving the distance. And this is the problem. The universe is where we learn about the laws of physics. The universe is the place where the laws of physics can exist. We need the universe to define those things. Okay, now let's take that thought. Hold on to that thought for a second. I'm going to be performing a marriage here this afternoon for some close friends. And I've been performing, it seems like, a lot of marriages lately. It just must be the season to be married. And one of the things that I'm going to tell this couple as we're talking is that we have this notion in our culture that we can just find the person that we love, find the soulmate. And that love, as we stand there at the altar, is going to be great enough to be able to propel this marriage through the next 40 years. And I'm here to tell you that there's too much friction in life for that to happen. It's not going to work. The ancient Hebrews had a different view of marriage. Where we believe that love precedes marriage, the ancients believed that marriage preceded love. Their marriages were arranged. Husband and wife didn't even meet each other until the day of their betrothal or the day of their marriage. So how is it that they were supposed to have a love that was going to propel them through? They understood that marriage is where we learn how to love. Marriage is the place where that happens. It's like the universe is a place where physics happens. Marriage is a place where we learn how to love. And you know, just for fun, and because I'm still a frustrated actor somewhere in there, I wanted to... How many of you have seen Fiddler on the Roof? Okay, most of you. It's a wonderful musical, and it's a wonderful story about a Jewish family in pre-revolutionary Russia, 1905, I believe. And everything is changing in the world, both macro, because the revolution is getting ready to happen, the persecution of the Jews is getting ready to happen, and in the micro, because in Tevye's family, he's got five daughters, and the oldest three are ready to get married, and they're not going to go by the traditional ways. He's fighting to keep his traditions alive. But each daughter of the first three oldest daughters ends up marrying someone that she loves and not going through the arranged marriage of the shadkan, the matchmaker, right? And so when the second daughter announces that she has fallen in love with someone that he didn't pick, he has a talk with his wife, and he's realizing that the world is changing and he can't stop it. But at the same time, he's got to reevaluate, how does this affect my marriage? You know, I didn't meet my wife until we were married. And so he says to her, Golda, I have decided to give Perchik permission to become engaged to our daughter Hodel. And Golda says, what? He's poor. He has nothing, absolutely nothing. He's a good man, Golda. I like him. And what's more important, Hodel likes him. Hodel loves him. So what can we do? It's a new world, love. Then he says, yeah, I know, it's a New York Jew, I'm trying. Golda, do you love me? Do I what? Do you love me? Do I love you? With our daughters getting married and this trouble in the town, you're upset, you're worn out, go inside, go lie down, maybe it's indigestion. Golda, I'm asking you a question. Do you love me? You're a fool. I know. But do you love me? Do I love you? For 25 years, I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked the cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now? Golda, the first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared. I was shy. I was nervous. So was I. But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. And now I'm asking, Golda, do you love me? I'm your wife. I know, but do you love me? Do I love him? For 25 years I've lived with him, fought him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is? Then do you love me? I suppose I do. And I suppose I love you too. And then they both say, it doesn't change a thing. But even so, after 25 years... It's nice to know. I don't know if that sounds very romantic to all of you. But it's not just about romance, is it? You know, the most important things in life creep up on us. We don't even see them coming. We don't even realize that they've taken root in our lives until all of a sudden something pops through and we realize we've changed. Love is like that. Love creeps up on us. The infatuation that we feel when we first meet someone, it comes and it goes, and we can rekindle and we can do this and do that. But you know what? If there's not a showing up for 25 years and milking cows and doing laundry and raising children, how can you say that you love anything? Marriage is the place where love can exist. Marriage is the place where we learn how to love. There's something here that's driving us. Because if that's true, then what is life teaching us? What is life all about? What's this difficulty stuff going on? You know, the Jews of Jesus' day believed that human beings lived between heaven and earth. There was a notion that this earth was the place of separate form and function, that you could conceive of yourself as being separate from each other, and you could operate on those principles if you wanted to. But as they looked at the skies, the place where they believed that God's breath resided, they saw that as the place of continuity, the place of unity, where everything connected. You know, it's the difference between a wave and a particle. And so they believed that the human being's job on earth was to bring heaven to earth and to bring earth to heaven. That is to merge the two, to bring them together into unity. That's what we're here to do. Truly believe that. In fact, later Jews in the Middle Ages gave it a name. They called it Hanhagah. And Hanhagah, which literally means, you know, guiding power. But what they understood was that God created this space for us in which we could know Him who is unknowable. They called Him Ein Sof, which means without end. But really what it means is without edges, without boundaries, without anything to grasp onto, to hold onto, to conceive of it all. How do we relate to such a God? We relate here and now in Hanhagah. Because bounded by the law, bounded by Torah, it gave us the edges that we needed to grasp Him. We couldn't grasp Him directly, but we could grasp how we are supposed to live with Him. We could learn about Him by continuing to show up in life, to do the things that we do. This life is the place where we could learn about God. We could learn what it means to be here, what our meaning and purpose is all about. But it starts with the law. It has to be with the law, because the law defined all of this in the Jewish mind. Now look what Jesus says here at Matthew 5:17. Do you think that I came to abolish the law and the prophets? I did not. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. So basically what we're saying here is that the law is where we learn about truth. Law is the place where truth can exist. And truth is where we learn about freedom. Truth is the place where freedom can exist. And the beautiful part is we don't have to have all this figured out before we start down the path. In fact, we're not supposed to have it all figured out. As we experientially move through these experiences in life, as we make the choices we make and do the things that we do, that truth creeps up on us. And we suddenly realize, I've been transformed. Something has changed. Jesus said at the Lord's Prayer, right? He said, your will be done. As in heaven, so on earth. Same thing, merging the two. That the fulfillment of the law is the unity of heaven and earth. And Jesus says something very interesting here when he says heaven and earth will pass away. And the word there in Aramaic is abar. And abar literally means to cross boundaries. What is Jesus saying? He's saying when heaven and earth cross their boundaries, in other words, when heaven and earth become one, then there will be no need for the law because it will be fulfilled. The law is here to teach us how to cross the boundaries between heaven and earth, to move from a place of separation to a place of unity. And it will be in force until that lesson is learned, until heaven and earth merge, is what Jesus is saying here in this passage. But we got to remember that the law is not an absolute code. It's not just about following rules. In fact, the word Torah doesn't mean law as we think of law. It means instruction or guidance. It's kind of like Pirates of the Caribbean. The pirate code. You know, you got to follow the code. Well, it's really more of a guideline than a code, you know. Well, how is the law a command that we need to follow and also a guideline at the same time? I mean, either it's a law or it's a suggestion, but how can it be both? Or maybe it's a law that leads us to a suggestion. See, these are ways that we have to, how does this all work? Some of you know that I was raised Catholic, and I spent 12 years in Catholic school. And then as I graduated high school, I joined a monastery with the House of Formation in Chicago. And what you don't know about me is that when I was younger, I had a real authority complex. Maybe some of you have figured that out anyway. I don't know. I guess I shouldn't assume. But one of the things, there are three vows that you take when you enter the monastery, and actually in the first year as a postulant you don't take any vows, but they're chastity, poverty, and obedience. And of the three, that first year, the difficult one for me was obedience. I just had such a hard time. And moving into this house of formation with a lot of young guys my age, 17, 18 years old, and then there were older monks that were sometimes 50, 60, even 70 years old. Some of them had been put out to pasture, and they were just sort of living there, and others were taking breaks. And who knows? Anyway, there's this conglomeration of men trying to live in this house together. I come from the beach. I had spent my entire summer on the beach, and so I came, tanned black. I hadn't had shoes on in 3 months. And my hair, I think, was even red, bleached out from the sun. And I show up after staying up almost the entire night the night before, come to chapel the first morning in a baseball jersey, torn jeans, bare feet. And didn't even realize, I don't know what I was thinking, I probably wasn't thinking, I was promptly escorted out and told that there was a dress code here, that we always had to wear shoes and socks, that that we had to always be wearing something that was appropriate for the rest of the group. And furthermore, there was a curfew, there was a bedtime, and that was, I think, 9:30, and you couldn't be up after that. And, oh, by the way, there's no naps in the afternoon, and there are chores that you have to do, and all of these different rules that to me were just arbitrary and intrusive, and I hated them. And so I made it my mission to make my novice master's life a living hell, because I pushed. But you know what? I pushed kind of sneakily, and I pushed just hard enough that I would always get a laugh from the group. But I never pushed so much, at least not in the first. So what I would start to do is wear shoes but with no socks, and I would try to get away with that. And so he got into the habit of every time that we walked into the cafeteria or whatever, that he would come by, have to look under the table, see if I was wearing socks, send me back out to put my socks on, and it became this running joke. And so one day I got the bright idea. I went out to put my socks on, and I put my socks on over my shoes and came back in with my socks over my shoes, because he didn't tell me what order I had to wear my socks and shoes, of course. And it got a big laugh, but you could see what was happening. You know, same thing with television. You know, we could watch 1 hour a night, and the oldest person got to choose the station. It was just on and on and on, and I kept pushing and pushing, and everything was difficult for me until finally I had a showdown with the novice master, who was an ex-wrestling coach, by the way. So he cleaned my clock one day, I'll never forget, and I jumped in the room, put me in a half Nelson, and knocked all the wind out of me. He was screaming in my ear. He just lost it. After that, in his office, this is all in the religious order, see? This is what we do. In his office, after that incident, he looked at me, and he finally said something that made sense. He said, "I can't let you win, because if you win, I lose all those other guys." And, you know, even at 18, as stupid as I was, as narcissistic as I was, as authority complexed as I was, it sunk in, and I realized he's trying to build a community. He's trying to get these 10 guys, fresh out of high school, who didn't know anything about anything, who are scared, who are away from home, and try to get them to act cohesively. And not only that, those 18 and 17-year-olds had to work and live with 60 and 70 year olds. And how do you set a common denominator that works across all of that? I still remember his name, Brother Dalton. I respect him so much now for what he was trying to do. At that point, I stopped acting out. I stopped pushing. But it wasn't until years later that I realized that every one of those rules had a reason behind it. It wasn't arbitrary. It wasn't stupid. It was there to teach us how to live in community. Now think for a moment. If you're trying to teach a child abstract concepts, you're trying to teach a child about dignity, about responsibility, about justice. How do you do that? Those are abstract. There's no concrete form. They can't visualize that. How do you get those points across? Well, the answer is you don't do it directly, because you're just talking at them then. They're not going to get it. So what do? You give them a dress code where they do have to wear white shirts and ties at school. And you tell them that there's going to be homework that they have to take home and they have to accomplish. And the results of that homework and the results of the test are going to be published for all to see, so that rewards can be given and shame can be actually experienced. dignity, responsibility, justice. The concrete rules of the law are giving us the edges that we can hold on to find the principles, the character of the God behind them. This is what's going on in life. Life is the place where we can learn to cross boundaries between heaven and earth. The difficulties of life, those difficulties are there for the reason of being able to move us through whatever we need to move through. They're not arbitrary, and they're not given to us by God. Life is where we learn to cross boundaries. And meeting life's difficulties teaches us these unseen intangibles. Everybody, marriage is difficult only until you realize that the differences between you and your spouse are there to help you to create the opportunity to learn how to love someone other than yourself. When you can cross that boundary and you can become that spouse who is different from you in many different ways, that's where we learn how to love. That's why staying in marriage teaches us how to love. Because it's that difference that is what draws us to the center. As soon as we understand that, as soon as we realize what marriage is really about, it gets easier. You don't fight every little thing that's going on. You're not trying to make your spouse into what you want them to be or what you think that you are. You're allowing them, you're celebrating the differences, allowing them to stand, but allowing them to move you toward the center. The law is only difficult until we realize that the principles behind the rules are those that God is exhibiting in his own character. Once we realize that, the rules cease to be arbitrary. They're not just something that we're blindly obeying, not just following rules, but we're letting them change us from inside out. We are starting now to become, as in a marriage, become the principles that the law is mirroring, the law is showing us. We're learning actually the mind of God. And then finally, life is difficult until we realize that the difficulties themselves are the boundaries between heaven and earth. Those difficulties are the edges that we experience. And crossing them is literally teaching us about unity. Crossing the boundaries of life is teaching us about the heart of God and bringing us into community. Yes, life is difficult because it's an endless series of problems. But if we can change the way that we think about the problems and about the difficulties, it's going to change the things that we do, which will change the feelings that we have about life. Our attitude toward life can change. We don't have to wake up each day dreading the day's problems. We can be computer geeks who smile because it's something we haven't experienced before. And we can move into it, put another tool in our belt, and be able to get up the next day truly fortified, knowing that God is always there at our side. Life is only as difficult as we think it is. Let's think differently about life and see what that can do to change our experience of what God has for us every single day. Let's pray. Father, you have engineered everything with precision. You have created our lives and created this universe. You've created, it's like a playpen within which we can play, we can learn, we can relate, we can find our meaning and purpose. But there are no sharp edges. There's nothing that can really hurt us. It's the space that you have given us to find out about you until we can cross the boundary and become one with you. Help us to see that we can live life this way. We can relax. We can make friends with the difficulties and then find that they don't throw us the way that they used to. Thank you for being that kind of God, Lord, that holds us and guides us and will never let us go. We praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Let's all stand.